Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello. Thank you for joining us for the Sunday, April 28th, Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Mary Carley. We begin with the following articles. Prescription drug shortages hit home in the Springs, by Debbie Kelly. Goodwill Hunting, by Stephanie Earls. Universities scramble to respond to protesters, by Nicole Brambilla. Town Hall will tackle the state's number one issue, immigration, by the editor, Vince Bizdek. Prescription drug shortages hit home in the Springs, impacting many. Colorado resident Tara Rosner wasn't aware of a widespread prescription drug shortage until about 2 weeks ago, when she tried to fill her 16-year-old daughter's prescription for a pump for her type 1 diabetes. They were out, and it took a week to get the full prescription in, Rosner said. In the meantime, her teen used some pens she had at home to dispense the insulin that's vital for her to maintain good health. It was disruptive, and I didn't even realize the delay was an ongoing thing and not an isolated incident, Rosner said. The development is concerning and worrisome, she said, echoing the thought of many across the nation facing similar or worse situations, including long waits, drug substitutions, or doing without. There are a lot of different things going on, and it's frustrating for everyone, said registered pharmacist Barry Patterson, owner of the medicine shop at the Bond Shopping Center in Colorado Springs. There are tons of shortages since COVID and even before. The number of prescription drugs that are in short supply hit a record high of 323 medications in the first quarter of this year, according to data from the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. Delayed medications include some for treating cancer and chronic diseases, including diabetes, high blood pressure, and asthma. But the problem started pre-pandemic and may not be fixed anytime soon, say industry leaders in Colorado Springs. It's like an onion. You can peel the layers back and see what's going on, and it's disgusting, said registered pharmacist Shannon Bethel. She and her husband, Scott, own Ivy Wild Pharmacy in Colorado Springs, which recently moved from its 100-year-old shop in the Ivy Wild neighborhood to downtown, now located at 311 South Nevada Avenue. During COVID, the slowdown in the supply chain for anything from groceries to building materials and medical supplies affected pharmaceuticals across the board. Now, specific categories of drugs have been hit by unrelated issues. For example, a massive United Health cybersecurity attack in February led to 6 weeks of not being able to properly bill, which put pressure on companies, Bethel said. Coupled with other factors, it's becoming more common for patients to wait weeks or months to have prescriptions filled, which can adversely affect drug therapy, compromise or delay medical procedures, and result in medication errors, according to the American Society of Health System Pharmacists' website. When feasible, patients are advised to switch to similar drugs that are in stock, pharmacists say, but that's not always possible. People can also call different pharmacies to fill prescriptions, Bethel said, but many times the same suppliers are used. Also, families should keep in mind that adult medications often are not recommended as replacements for pediatric medications, said Sarah Davis Bonner, a spokesperson for Children's Hospital Colorado. With the January 1 discontinuation of the Flovent asthma inhaler, doctors have noticed an increase in families struggling to keep their child's asthma symptoms under control, she said. Parents should work closely with primary care providers to find proper alternatives and appropriate strengths and dosages for children. Casey Dugan, Vice President of Pharmacy at Children's Hospital Colorado, which supplies 16 locations, including Full Service Hospital in Colorado Springs, Children's Hospital, is monitoring 29 pharmaceuticals that fall within a 90 to 30 day supply range and works daily to control inventory to ensure pediatric patients receive what they need, Dugan said. Generic medicines for pain control, sedation, and anxiety, as well as electrolytes, other supplements, and a few antiviral antibiotics, are on the system's current watch list. We have daily team huddles monitoring for disruption in the supply chains, review back orders, find wholesalers that have products in stock. The amount of effort the organization has to go through daily and weekly just to manage these items wasn't the case 10 years ago, Dugan said. Ivy Wild Pharmacies Bethel blames insurance companies for part of the cracked picture. They get kickbacks or rebates on Medicare and Medicaid, and we have to give brand name drugs when there are other cheaper generics, she said. That's straining both generic drug manufacturers that may not offer kickbacks and mom and pop pharmacies, Bethel said, some of which are going out of business as a result. We have to pay bills in 12 days, but insurance companies drag their feet on paying, she said. Shortages of generic Adderall were born during the pandemic when more people were being diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, Bethel said. But not enough pills were produced to meet the unexpected increase in demand, which has continued, Bethel said. Production is dictated by the Federal Drug Enforcement and Food and Drug Administrations, which Bethel said can be an issue because they'll undershoot. That's what happened with generic Adderall. Opioid pain relievers are less readily available now as well because the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration has tightened regulations due to overuse or illicit use of narcotics. That's led to increased accidental overdoses nationwide, Patterson said. You can only fill so many, and the companies only make so many, which is driving people who have pain to the streets for illegal drugs. And then they get the knockoffs that are laced with fentanyl and can be deadly, Bethel said. A recent rise in popularity of some diabetes medications that also help with weight loss, such as Ozempic, have created shortages for that group of drugs, Patterson said. Availability is expected to improve, however, as another choice comes on the market. In November, the FDA approved Eli Lilly's two new brands, Mounjaro for diabetes and Zepbound, with the same main ingredients but specified for weight loss. You've got people who need these drugs for diabetes, Bethel said, and you've got stars promoting the same drug for weight loss. Another popular medication that's been scarce is albuterol, a liquid rescue inhaler for asthma patients. Bethel said insurance companies wouldn't cover it for lack of rebates. The product also suffered recalls by some manufacturers in 2020 and 23, and a major manufacturer shut down production at three factories 14 months ago, which further reduced supplies. Bethel attributes discontinuation of the ProAir HFA inhaler and albuterol product to the manufacturer not making enough money on it. It's just crazy, Bethel said. I know everyone wants their medications for free, but you can't make them for free and you can't dispense them for free, and they are expensive. Profit margins are slim in the healthcare industry, Dugan said. There are legislative proposals to help resolve some of the issues and a plan from the Biden administration to increase domestic production since U.S. drug manufacturers rely on overseas suppliers for pharmaceutical ingredients. National advocacy groups have also been working on reliable manufacturing domestically, better transparency when there's a disruption, the cost to hospitals and others to manage drug shortages, effective incentivizing for manufacturers and healthcare providers to prevent medications from expiring, and leaving inventory that is cash sitting on the shelves, Dugan said. The upshot is that the situation does impact providers' ability to efficiently provide care long-term and also drives up the overall cost of care because of the amount of effort it takes to do that. And prices increase because of supply and demand issues. Goodwill hunting. Competitive shoppers grapple for deals at Massive Outlet in the Springs. Fans liken it fondly to indoor dumpster diving, a feeding frenzy for the starved of stuff and addiction waiting to happen if it hasn't already. Goodwill of Colorado's Outlet Center is all those things and more, an end-of-the-line ecosystem and mortal reminder that when we shop till we drop, we leave a heck of a lot behind. In many ways, what you find is like Goodwill anywhere, everything from complete garbage to brand new items. The shopping experience is different, more like a treasure hunt. And the price is right, said outlet shopper Loyal Olson. While the eco-conscious gathered for Earth Day trash, cleanups, and nature walks, shoppers at this last chance retail rodeo for tons of donated items in southern Colorado celebrated the second R of the Eco Trinity, reduce, reuse, recycle, in fitting, frenetic, and frugal fashion. As happens roughly every 20 minutes or so during opening hours, a Goodwill outlet employee in a blue and yellow safety vest wheeled a cart down the center aisle of the retail side of this 100,000-square-foot building, unspooling a caution rope that shall not be crossed, lest you earn a stern rebuke or ousting for repeated offenses. A new flotilla loaded with textiles or hard goods, trash, treasures, and everything in between, would be docking shortly. Picked over bins were whisked away. Shoppers who knew the drill, meaning pretty much everyone here at 1 p.m. on a weekday, queued up behind the worn yellow lines on the floor as one by one, 4x8-foot bins laden with fresh old wares were steered into place, 2 abreast, 5 deep. Craning of necks is accepted. Aggressive pointing frowned upon, and plucking or touching a definite no-no until the official okay is given. Shop. And it's like someone fired up a giant rototiller with arms for blades. Plush toys, purses, and anything else in the way fly as bargain hunters dig. The crash and shatter of breaking things spikes the air and the nerves. There's a good reason children under 16 aren't allowed at the outlet, and gloves are highly recommended. Some of the customers are here all the time, and they know what they're looking for and ready to buy, said Brian Robinson, Goodwill of Colorado's salvage and sustainability specialist. I think they call it competitive. Universities scrambled to respond to protesters. Pro-Palestinian protests spread across campuses in the U.S., including Denver. The clashes with police and arrests of pro-Palestinian protesters that have erupted in colleges across the nation were on full display on Friday when Denver officers cleared an encampment and arrested 24 protesters on a campus shared by 3 universities. And just as university officials elsewhere in the country struggle to respond, the protest appears to have left Colorado administrators scrambling to figure out how to deal with the activists. One crucial difference, however, is that in the case of the Aurora area protest, university officials did not take days before deciding how to respond. Protesters had erected tents on Thursday. By Friday afternoon, the police moved in to dismantle them and arrest 24 protesters. By contrast, the tents are still up at Columbia University more than a week after police arrested 100 protesters. The protesters there said they'd reached an impasse with university administrators and intended to continue their encampment. It appears that some university officials here did not anticipate that the rallies in New York, Michigan, and other universities would spill over into Colorado. Despite the 30 protests on the Aurora area campus since the October 7th Hamas attacks that killed 1,200 in southern Israel and prompted retaliatory strikes from Israel. In the days leading up to students erecting tents on the lawn of the Tivoli Quad of the Aurora area campus, officials appeared to dismiss the idea that the unrest seen elsewhere in the country would break out in Colorado. The Gazette had reached out to several universities across the state to inquire how administrators might respond to similar protests in Colorado. On the morning of the protests, before the activists erected more than a dozen tents, Jeff Howard, the spokesman for the University of Colorado, said that the preparation question was not applicable. After discussion with students that included Angie Passione, the executive director of the Colorado Department of Higher Education, and a member of the governor's cabinet broke down, police tore down the makeshift encampment and arrested protesters. In a statement, the Aurora Area Higher Education Center defended the decision by noting a campus policy that prohibits camping on the premises. Campus authorities also suggested that national disruptors had infiltrated the protest. "We fully support the right of students to assemble peacefully," Aurora area campus officials said. In a statement, "Still, it's essential to note that Aurora area campus policy prohibits camping on the premises because of health, safety, and security considerations. The Aurora area campus includes CU Denver, Metropolitan State University of Denver, and the Community College of Denver." Howard characterized the majority of the protests held on campus as small, but noted 8 of the rallies drew 50 or more people, and the largest had 160 protesters. The Aurora area protest, which began Thursday, attracted hundreds of people. Others, though, were not surprised protesters in Denver would mimic the rallies that have nabbed headlines for the past week. Scott Levin, regional director of the Anti-Defamation League Mountain States region, said the Aurora campus has been a hub for political activism against Israel for years. "I think the encampments are likely to get worse before they get better," Levin said. "The pro-Palestinian rallies unfolding on college campuses across the U.S., Levin said, are frightening to Jews. A recent survey of college students by the Anti-Defamation League and Hillel International found before October 7th that 67% of Jewish students felt physically safe on campus. After October 7th, it dropped to 46%. Jews hear a clear demand for Israel's annihilation in the chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." The river is the Jordan, and the sea is the Mediterranean, between which lie Israel and the Palestinian territories. Activists, however, say it's a call for peace and equality after 75 years of an Israeli statehood and military rule over millions of Palestinians. Students at the rally Thursday night confirmed that their protest was in solidarity with protesters on campuses across the nation. On Wednesday, the day before the first tent stakes were pressed into the ground, Tim Carroll, an MSU spokesperson, said the university was monitoring protest activity happening on college campuses nationwide and reviewing policies and training so that we can be best prepared to ensure a safe environment here. Our top priority is always the safety of our students and community, and we'll continue to collaborate with our partners at the Aurora Campus Police Department to ensure the well-being of students, employees, and visitors, Carroll said. Adding, our role is to educate and provide forums for learning by engaging in thoughtful, respectful dialogue, and will continue to foster civil discourse while ensuring safety and that our academic mission is maintained. In the wake of the Hamas attacks, officials have taken proactive steps, such as a letter from MSU President Janine Davidson in the fall, reminding students of the importance of civil discourse. I know emotions are especially raw right now, and when passions run high, it's easy to dismiss others or make them into objects of contempt, Davidson wrote. So let me be clear. While we support the free expression of opinions, discrimination, bullying, and threats of violence cannot be tolerated. An Aurora Area Higher Education Center reminder online also warns students that assemblies are prohibited in campus buildings. While Denver campuses have been a hotbed for student protests, the rallies haven't been widespread. Neither the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley nor Colorado Christian University in Lakewood reported students holding pro-Palestinian rallies. A faith-based institution, CCU Chancellor Donald W. Sweeting, said he didn't expect to see protests on his campus. A university spokesperson said that students are required to sign a statement of faith when enrolling, which means the student population is more likely to hew to Christian teachings and be sympathetic to Israel. We never want to forget our Jewish roots as a Christian university, Sweeting said, adding, the worst thing to happen to Palestinians is to have Hamas rule over them. Last December, CCU hosted local Jewish leaders over dinner and a prayer vigil, in which faculty members and students expressed support for Israel and its war against Hamas. During the fundraiser, two Israeli students spoke about the support they're getting from faculty members and students alike. And a student leader reiterated that support to the Israeli students and to the fundraiser's Jewish attendees. In an open letter to university presidents on Friday, the ACLU warned that schools should not single out students with a particular viewpoint or censor, discipline, or disproportionately punish them. Police, the ACLU argued, should only be employed as a last resort. Inviting armed police into a campus protest environment, even a volatile one, can create unacceptable risks for all students and staff, the ACLU said. University officials must also be cognizant of the history of law enforcement using inappropriate and excessive force on communities of color, including Black, Brown, and immigrant students. Moreover, arresting peaceful protesters is also likely to escalate, not calm, the tensions on campus, as events of the past week have made abundantly clear. The decision to arrest Denver protesters has followed similar scenes unfolding at college campuses across the country. Over 100 pro-Palestinian protesters were arrested at Columbia University in New York, prompting the Ivy League school to cancel in-person classes. At Michigan State University, students set up an encampment on campus to pressure the university to divest, the same demand the protesters in Denver made, from Israeli companies and for the U.S. government to stop backing Israel's military. Shannon Birch, a Colorado State University senior, said having watched in horror the slaughter of innocent civilians, she had to do something. Showing up at the rally, she and other protesters said, was the least she could do. For months and months, I've been watching children being killed with our money, Birch said. On Friday, Denver Mayor Mike Johnston went to the Aurora area campus in an attempt to persuade the protesters to voluntarily dismantle their tents. We're here to try to make sure we can help you all exercise your right to protest peacefully, he said. To do that, the mayor said, the campus must be able to continue to operate. Johnston was interrupted several times. Do you support genocide? The protesters asked the mayor. I'm going to talk for 60 seconds and I'll walk. If you want to listen, you can. If not, that's your choice, Johnston replied. Johnston told the protesters that erecting the tents violates campus policy, and if they took them down within the next 30 minutes, they could continue to protest, adding, we have no desire to make arrests. It's more of the same. Our demands are not being met, one protester told Johnston, who replied, I have no capacity to meet any of your demands. Town Hall will tackle state's number one issue, immigration. They let, I think the real number is 15 or 16 million people into our country. When they do that, we got a lot of work to do. They're poisoning the blood of our country. I said, no, they're not humans. They're not humans. They're animals. This is what Donald Trump said in 2024. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. That's the inscription on the Statue of Liberty. How does a reasonable American reconcile two polar opposite ideas like this? On the one hand is a statement of national values, that our country should be a beacon for immigrants of all kinds, and in those immigrants lies America's repeated revitalization. On the other hand, we have a former president's statement that immigrants are lesser and are overwhelming our resources and threatening to ruin the things that made our country great to begin with. Which is it? What's the right approach to immigration in the year 2024? Clearly, immigration has become a complex emotional debate in which Americans do not hold neatly monolithic views. Even if we do still subscribe to those words on Miss Liberty, which I'm guessing most of us do, we just don't have the resources anymore to take on all the world's huddled masses in an unchecked flow. Otherwise, those of us who are second and third and fourth generation immigrants, which describes most of us, descended from immigrants to this country at one time or another, end up cutting back on services for those citizens in need who are not newly arrived. And a flood of too many immigrants from one trouble spot in the world, namely Mexico and Latin America, steals away slots for refugees from other trouble spots, including Eastern Europe and the Mideast. Then our immigration policies lose their promise of equal opportunity for all. Denver has now become one of the country's flashpoints in this frustrating debate. At last count, 41,000 immigrants had arrived in the city in the last 16 months, and city officials said the response this year will cost $90 million, and they'll need to cut other city services, including public safety, to pay for the care of those immigrants. At the same time, recent studies show illegal immigration pumps $2 billion into the Colorado economy each year. Meanwhile, Aurora, Colorado Springs, and other jurisdictions have adopted resolutions saying they cannot afford to spend money on this crisis. Coloradans now say this is the most important issue in the state, according to a recent poll. Governor Greg Abbott of Texas is the person who brought this crisis to Denver's doorstep by busing immigrants out of his state to sanctuary cities, including Denver, Chicago, and New York, something he's unapologetic about. Before we began busing illegal immigrants up to New York, it was just Texas and Arizona that bore the brunt of all the chaos and all the problems that came with it, Abbott said. Now the rest of America is understanding exactly what's going on. So what exactly is going on? We hope to try to answer that question by taking a hard look at all sides on the immigration crisis rolling Denver and the country right now. In a Denver Gazette 9 News Colorado conversation on Tuesday, May 7th, from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Stockyards Event Center, located at 2004 National Western Drive in Denver. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Please join us live at the Event Center and bring your questions, or watch the debate, which will be live streamed on DenverGazette.com, ColoradoPolitics.com, and 9News.com. Panelists at the town hall include key players and a range of different perspectives in the debate. Mike Johnston, Mayor of Denver, Mike Kaufman, Mayor of Aurora, Violeta Chapin, Associate Dean for Community and Culture and Clinical Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Law School, Abe Layden, Commissioner, Douglas County, and DJ Summers, Director of Policy and Research for the Common Sense Institute. Moderator Del Porto, editor of the Denver Gazette and Colorado Politics, and a first-generation immigrant himself, tells me panelists will try to answer the toughest of questions. Why are so many immigrants flooding into the country and specifically into Denver now? What needs to be done in Washington to stop the border crisis? Do immigrants steal jobs from American cities? Or do they do jobs like cleaning toilets and picking fruit that Americans don't want to do? Is the issue jobs, or is it more about housing, when we already have an affordable housing crisis in Colorado? Has Denver helped to create the crisis it's in by offering immigrants free shelter and transportation? Should Denver repeal its sanctuary city ordinances? Johnston, the mayor at the center of the current storm, who will be one of our panelists, recently gave a preview of the complexity of the conversation to come. There's a cycle that's been happening for hundreds of years in America, Johnston said. People live in a home country that denies them fundamental rights and opportunities. And so, after struggle or persecution or violence, they turn their eyes to that beacon of freedom we call America. Each of these waves of immigration seem overwhelming at the time, but each become in our American story a vibrant thread that wove the fabric of America. We built with them the greatest country in the world. Doesn't mean it's easy. And when migrants began to arrive in Denver by the busload, we faced a crisis, the biggest in the country, one that threatened to overwhelm the city. Johnston's statement begs one overarching question we hope the town hall can answer. In the long run, is Denver's immigration problem solvable? And who are the ones to solve it? On the editorial page, lawmakers fall short again on property tax relief. To no one's surprise, pending property tax relief legislation that will be officially unveiled this week at the Capitol wouldn't cure what ails Colorado's homeowners. It wouldn't even ease their pain much. At best, it's a mere balm for deep wounds inflicted by skyrocketing property taxes. As noted in news reports last week, previewing the awaited property tax plan, it largely reiterates a proposal released last month by a special property tax commission impaneled by the legislature. And like the commission's proposal, it falls short in fundamental ways. The proposal, pitched and supported by ruling Democrats at the Capitol, does include a nominal cap on property tax increases. It purportedly holds increases in total property tax revenue to the rate of inflation. But that cap is really more of a sieve. It would exempt property taxes collected for schools and home rule cities. Of course, most of the average homeowner's property tax bill is for schools. Exempting them, not to mention home rule cities, could nearly negate the proposal's provisions for taming the 19 to 25% surges in residential property tax bills homeowners are seeing this year. And other local governments would be able to evade the cap as well. They could raise their mill levies to generate more revenue than the cap allows, so long as their governing bodies, not the voting public, approve the mill levy hikes at public meetings, which of course all of them would do. In other words, it's not much of a cap at all. The proposal has some modest sweeteners, like phased-in reductions in the property assessment rate for commercial property. It would also let owners of single-family homes reduce their taxable assessment value by 10%, up to $75,000, meaning the break tops out for homes valued at $750,000. Any home valued over that threshold, as so many middle-class Front Range homes are nowadays, wouldn't derive any additional benefit. Incredibly, this latest iteration of legislative property tax relief includes another fatal flaw. Legislative Democrats have tried to slip through on previous tries at tax relief. It would make homeowners pay for it themselves by tapping some of the surplus revenue they're supposed to get back from the state each year in the form of Tabor refunds. The premise of that galling feature is to backfill local governments that might get shortchanged by the proposal's theoretical revenue cap. Which raises an as yet unanswered question. Why would any local government come up short under this proposal when the minimal caps would only limit the rate of increase in property tax revenues to their coffers? The proposal's shadow author, the Commission on Property Tax, was created by lawmakers during last November's special legislative session on tax relief. The resulting relief was meager. Even after a public rebuke with the defeat of the legislators' Proposition HH, that was lawmakers' bait and shift tax hike disguised as property tax relief, which voters rejected by an 18-point margin only weeks earlier on the November 7th statewide ballot. The special session's minor tweaks covered only the tax bills that went out this spring. The commission was supposed to develop a long-term solution. This is all it could muster, which makes it all the more likely Colorado voters will embrace the far more substantive property tax relief that's on the statewide ballot this coming November. It would reset property values to 2020 levels, limit annual increases in property taxes to 4%, and lower the statutory residential and commercial assessment rates used to help calculate total tax bills. Lawmakers fear and loathe that proposal, but they had their chance. Three chances, in fact. It makes their latest a strikeout. Remembering through music. band holds memorial concert for former member killed in UCCS shooting. By Savannah Eller. Friday night at Sunshine Studios in Security Widefield was a time for music and remembrance for hundreds, as local bands celebrated Salee Montgomery and Sam Knopp, the two victims of the February University of Colorado Springs shooting, in a fundraising memorial concert. Among the headliners of the showcase were the former bandmates of Knopp, whose band Aeternum made its debut performance. The young musician had a part in the development of the hard rock band as he pursued a music major at UCCS. "It was just electrifying to hear him play," said former bandmate Jose Tenara. Described by bandmates as a skilled technical guitarist with a love of the classics, Knopp made an impression in the music community for his abilities and joy in playing. "He had a smirk on his face, loving what he was doing the whole time," said Tenero. The Friday concert raised $1,000 for the families of Montgomery and Knopp in ticket sales and a raffle. Among the items being sold was a t-shirt with the caption, "Legends Never Die," with the names of Knopp and Montgomery. Knopp's parents were at the concert. Amy Knopp said, "We just thought everyone was great." Lead Aeternum singer Kayla Smith said the music scene in Colorado Springs was in close-knit attendance. "It's a community where you either know the musician or you played in a band with someone they played with," she said. Musician Nikki C. with the band Misconduct concurred, saying he played with people who knew Knopp and felt his loss. "We were honored they asked us to come play," he said. "It's a very sad event, but we're happy to have been part of it." Growing incivility. Is Colorado's local government sector functional or dysfunctional? By Thelma Grimes, Colorado Politics. While much of the attention is focused on politics and governments at the state capitol, the bulk of decisions that directly affect people's daily lives often come out of the local city council, school board, and county commission. Indeed, the saying, "all politics is local," aptly describes the role that local governments play in shaping America's body politic. In fact, one think tank says 95% of all elected officials in the U.S. serve at the municipal level. But while local governments are perhaps the most significant arm of America's democratic polity, they have little oversight, begging the question, is the local government sector functional or dysfunctional? In Colorado, entire city councils have resigned amid controversies since 2023. State legislators have intervened by passing laws to keep towns operating. County commissions have engaged in numerous public battles. And school boards have become decidedly political. Professor Robert Pruse, chairman of Metropolitan State University's Political Science Department, said the current political climate is becoming more contentious at the local government levels. He said it started well before the 2020 pandemic, which many blame for the acrimony. Pruse speculated such contentiousness started 10 years ago, and he expects the trend to continue. One of the biggest culprits infecting a functioning elected board is internal disagreement. While Governor Jared Polis has been pushing civility through his Disagreeing Better program, local boards, just like the state legislature, cannot always see past the red. Several city councils have disbanded due to internal fighting. In Florence, with rumblings and rumors surrounding the work of the town's city attorney, city manager, and police chief, the entire council except the mayor resigned. Much of the controversy centered around the town's manager being unexpectedly fired in 2021 and another hired a year later. He was on the job for only 6 months before he was fired in a 6-1 vote. Current Florence Mayor Steve Wolf was a sitting council member when the controversy started. He later ran for the city's top spot and won, taking over in December 2023. Wolf, optimistic the city's now on the right track, said Florence was without a proper city council for 5 months. That meant that while city utility services and public safety operations continued, all other city business was put on hold. Wolf, who's resided in Florence since 1985, said while many residents may have avoided the drama, he felt compelled to run for mayor and work to right the ship. "I'm optimistic we're in a good place now," he said, adding that a new town manager, an attorney, and police chief have been hired. Getting the town back on track was not just left to the newly elected council. Wolf said they turned to the Colorado Municipal League for help. The group provided training on the rules of open meetings law, which is required for executive sessions, and how to deal with the public in times of uncertainty. Kevin Bomer, executive director of the Colorado Municipal League, said a significant part of his group's duties is to not parent, but to provide advice and direction to its members. Florence wasn't the only city facing a unique situation in 2023. The city council in Boone also resigned after the mayor and a sitting council member couldn't resolve their differences. Boone, a small community in Pueblo County, was without elected representation for 6 months. The disagreements started when the town's mayor charged that the sitting council member, Rita Rhodes, was not properly following town ordinances. According to news reports, after the town's council members resigned, Rhodes appointed herself mayor and allegedly led to clear the town's bank accounts of more than $400,000, preventing the town from paying bills for over 3 weeks. Rhodes later said it was the only way to save the town, adding she closed the accounts to avoid their misappropriation. Because of what happened in Florence and Boone, Bomer said the Colorado Municipal League worked with the governor's office to pass House Bill 1185 in 2023. The new law seeks to help towns conduct business and hold special elections to fill vacated seats amid abrupt resignations. These boards were in real conflict and couldn't do anything without a quorum, Bomer said. Usually vacancies are filled by appointment within 60 days. But when a council only has a mayor, that can't happen. When a council disagrees, Bomer said, conducting business can become challenging. When elected bodies like the Aurora Council disagree over whether kids should be allowed on the dais, the Municipal League often advises the entity to deal with disagreements internally by starting a dialogue and working on fixing relationships. In Douglas County, the 3-member county commission has been battling for years. While none of the commission members has resigned, they've all grown accustomed to pointing fingers, name-calling, and spending taxpayer dollars for investigations. Commissioners Abe Layden and George Teal, up for re-election, have formed an alliance with Commissioner Laura Thomas, who's term limited this year, the odd person out. Teal and Layden have voted to revoke Thomas's credit card privileges and censored her on more than one occasion. Representative Robert Marshall, a Democrat from Highlands Ranch, introduced a bill to require larger counties, such as Douglas County, to be represented by 5 commissioners instead of only 3. But the idea failed in both 2023 and 2024. In introducing the measures, Marshall said that some argued that he's just trying to fix Douglas County's issues. However, the second-year state representative said he since learned The problem isn't unique to Douglas County. All kinds of issues arise out of having only a three-member body. He noted, for example, that Boulder County has a Democratic board, which means the more conservative parts of the county are underrepresented. I believe there's a universal agreement that the Douglas County Commission has dysfunction, Marshall said. The commission got my attention when you have three at-large elected officials, but two can lock out one. That made me research the issue further and find out it's a bigger issue. It can pop up in any county. School boards have also been at odds in recent years. Despite having similar political views, arguments over directions in the Elizabeth School District resulted in multiple board members resigning and the remaining members appointing new ones. The cost of dysfunction. In 2023, Layden and Teal had Thomas investigated for malfeasance. After Thomas was found cleared of wrongdoing, she asked that her legal fees be paid. Teal and Layden refused and spent $30,000 to fight a lawsuit filed by Thomas. Meanwhile, Denver Public Schools spent $43,000 in 2022 on mediation for a board that, for the most part, aligned ideologically but disagreed with the district's direction, requiring them to hire a consultant to help guide them through decision-making at the board's annual retreat. In Douglas County, internal disagreements intensified after four new members were elected to the school board in 2022. Notably, the disagreements included the firing of the school district superintendent by a 4-3 vote that year. The decision to fire Corey Wise costs the district over $833,000 after he filed a lawsuit alleging retaliation and discrimination. The school board's actions also led to State Representative Marshall filing a lawsuit, claiming most board members violated open meeting laws before the vote to fire Wise, and a judge agreed. The district opted to appeal, paying $186,000 in additional legal fees. After losing on appeal, the district agreed to pay Marshall over $100,000 for his legal fees. The acute dysfunction of the Douglas County School Board made me take notice, Marshall said. Would I say it's dysfunctional? Yes. Is it worse today than before? I don't know. Where do you put the blame? Again, I don't know. Disagreements with constituents have proven costly elsewhere. Several members of the Englewood City Council faced a recall last year when residents disagreed with the Code Next zoning policy established to serve as a framework for establishing clear community development policies. Three council members were forced into a recall months before the general election, costing the city $130,000. Before the recall election, which incumbents won, one embattled council member, Cheryl Wink, resigned after being questioned by a Colorado community media reporter about her attendance record. She was recorded referring to dissatisfied constituents as those little citizens, angry about everything. Still, Bummer maintained that most of the state's 270 councils function well, while admitting dysfunction exists among a small percentage of local governments. Potholes are nonpartisan. Bummer said candidates run for local seats for various reasons. Historically, the people who ran were longtime residents wanting to give back to the community. While that still happens, candidates have become more partisan, pushing an agenda or single issue to get elected. Pruce said the shift in reasons for running for office has changed the local political scene. As national issues take hold, candidates and local voters focus on partisan politics. A lot of local election ballots don't show a D or an R, but people know a candidate's faction. This is not really new, but at the same time, that partisan affiliation is at levels much higher than it's been in the past. Like Bomber, Yenny, executive director of the Colorado School Board Association, which represents 178 school districts, said most function well. And it's normal for national politics to seep into board conversations, causing divisions both among elected officials and residents. In closing, thank you for joining us for the Sunday Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Mary Carley.
AfterSight presents your Low Vision Resource of the Day. Today we would like to highlight Ignite Adaptive Sports. This organization provides outdoor snow sports lessons individualized to each student's unique needs, including students with low vision or blindness. Learn more by visiting www.igniteadaptivesports.org or calling 303-258-1166 or emailing info@igniteadaptivesports.org.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. You're listening to AfterSight.